Well, good morning, men. My name's Harold Long. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. And my sobriety date's April 7th, 1987. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. My home group is AA on the Rocks. Fine, strong three legacy group on Wednesday nights. JD's been here. JD's in the house, you can hook up with him. But it meets on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock Central Standard Time. St. Louis, Missouri, right by Botanical Gardens, right in the heart of the South City. Co-ed speaker meeting. It's also a hybrid. We still Zoom people in that want to come in and be a part of it. But proud to be a member of that group and come from a great line of sponsorship, three legacy sponsorship. It's all made a difference in how my life's turned out. And so that's what I'm going to really share about in this session that we have in our time this morning, is to share on that piece itself, is to talk about sponsorship, what it's meant to me, what it looks like, my resistance to it, you know, for a long time in my life, and especially in the early years, you know, how I've been sponsored, and, some of the many promises and blessings that came out of my life through sponsorship, how I sponsor today inside a prison system, sometimes inside a confined space of a treatment center, inside my home group, inside the world, long distance, all those things. I'll try to hit on that. But it just the thing I think is interesting, if you would ponder this for a moment, is just if somebody gave you a piece of paper and a pencil and said in 100 words or less, how would you define sponsorship? And that's something I would encourage you to wrestle with, is what does it really mean when someone says, you know, what is sponsorship? What does that mean to have a sponsor, and what does that look like? And one could say it's a relationship created by spiritual consent, that we agree to go on a journey together. It's somebody who's been ahead of you in this game called recovery, that this design for living. They've been practicing these principles in all their affairs, and they've been down this journey, and they can take you and walk shoulder to shoulder with you and help you rediscover life. You know, on and on and on the definition. But what does it really mean to you personally? I think knowing what that really means is important. Alcoholics Anonymous, our general service office, puts out a pamphlet on sponsorship. It's very available, probably in some of your literature racks in your home group. I think it's important to just look at what the group conscience of AA as a whole has to say what sponsorship looks like. And then Clarence Schneider, for you historians or people that have never heard that name, he was really wrote the first pamphlet or first anything in writing on sponsorship. And I just want to read just real quick the opening remarks of that pamphlet. This is written in 1944, and it was the first ever pamphlet written on sponsorship, and it's titled AA Sponsorships, its obligations and its responsibilities. And it was printed in Cleveland Central Committee under the title of AA Sponsorship, its opportunities and responsibilities. And this is the preface, and this is what I'm going to read of it. And I quote, "Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a potential sponsor of a new member and should clearly recognize the obligations and duties of such responsibility. The acceptance of an opportunity to take an AA plan to a sufferer of alcoholism entails very real and critically important responsibilities. Each member undertaking the sponsorship of a fellow alcoholic must remember that he is offering what is frequently the last chance of rehabilitation, sanity, and maybe life itself. Happiness, health, security, sanity, and life of a human beings are the things we hold in balance when we sponsor an alcoholic. No member among us is wise enough to develop a sponsorship program that can be successfully applied in every case. In the following pages, however, we have outlined a suggested procedure which, supplemented by members' own experience, has proven successful." End quote. And that's a pretty powerful, you know, statement. I mean, it's very well written. If you read on, I mean, it's very detailed on how we ask three questions, and if you can answer these three questions with satisfactory, then we're going to engage in a journey through the 12 steps, and here's the expectation of that. So it's pretty powerful. But another thing that's powerful, for those who maybe knew Clarence or heard his stories, his life ended tragically. You know, you could say it was through mental illness, you could say it was through, you know, just deterioration, rebellion, resentment, however you want to carry it out. But what I do know is my sponsor for a long time was a gentleman named Tom I from Southern Pines, North Carolina. Some of you know Tom or knew Tom. Tom and I were in North Carolina many years ago and at a conference together. And afterwards, me and about eight other guys that he sponsored, he says, "Look, I want to take us down the road here a few miles, and we're going to go back, and I want to show you something." We're like, "Yeah, let's go." And we drove down this stretch of highway, and we turn on this little gravel road in this backwoods of North Carolina. We drive back into the woods, and there's a cemetery there. And in that cemetery was buried Clarence Schneider. And we stood around his grave, 8, 9 of us, Tom holding court with us, and telling us the story of Clarence Schneider. This is arguably one of the founders of AA, or you put him in that category, one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. But through the deterioration of his life, when it came time to have his funeral, which was at the church right there, there was a church right next to the graveyard, Tom, my sponsor, said, "I'm pretty sure I was the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous at that funeral." So think about that. So what does that lesson teach me? I mean, and I think Bill wrote, I think it's on page 105 of Bill C's, that there's an excerpt from one of Bill's writings, and right in the middle of the page, I think the title of it is Chief Responsibility. And it goes on to say that our chief responsibility, and I'm paraphrasing, is to deliver an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous to the newcomer. It's our chief responsibility as a member, as a group, as a district, as an area, A as a whole. And that responsibility carries a lot of weight, which I think the pamphlet clearly defines. So that's what sponsorship has been for me. It's definitely been people that have delivered an adequate demonstration in my life, who invested in me, who asked me to walk into a spiritual consent with them to go on a journey that would transform my life. And so that's really what I want to share this morning, is what that journey's looked like for me in sobriety, the challenges I've had with it, the challenges I still have with sponsorship, just because of self and some of the shortcomings, some of the prices I paid throughout that. So this is really going to be a share of good, bad, and ugly this morning on this journey. But it's definitely need to have a sponsor. And I'll talk about who the gentlemen have been in my life and who have been my sponsors and how those relationships have went. I came to AA in 1979 through the Department of Corrections. And I was in Boonville Correctional Center. And I had another charge pending against me. And so when I got out, they immediately just took me to the next place, to a detention center in northern Missouri, Derry County Detention Center. And while I was in that detention center, a couple fine members from Alcoholics Anonymous brought a meeting into that space. Now, I was far from conceding that I was alcoholic, but it was definitely my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, part of that plea bargain, because I had a prosecutor and I had a parole officer that knew my condition better than I knew myself, knew that I was suffering from an illness, wanted to give me some grace and give me a break, and they said, "Look, we're going to offer you this opportunity. You can either be charged on this, and we're going to revoke your parole, and you're going to go back to Boonville Correctional Center for at least 2.5 more years, or you can go into treatment center for 30 days. Now, I quit school when I was 13 years old, right? But I had enough math to know that 30 days was a heck of a lot shorter than 2.5 years. So I took the plea bargain. I went to treatment for the first time in 1980. And by the time the calendar turned to 80, and I was in this treatment center for 30 days. And I didn't stay sober. I just did my time, and I'll talk about that maybe later today. But that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come back to AA until 1987, when I burnt my life into the ground and was inside the cage again in a lot of trouble at this point in time in my life. And I got on my knees in that cell, and I said a prayer I've heard from this podium a million times, and it was simply, "God, help me." And from that moment till now, I've never had to take another drink of alcohol. But it led me back to that same treatment center that I was in 1980, which is 2.5 hours from St. Louis. Lots of places to get help in St. Louis. I knew none of them, but I knew that place. This is where I think that adequate demonstration of AA is so imperative. And so I made it back to that space, and I didn't go to that space to get sober necessarily, although I had a strong desire not to drink. I didn't go there to work steps or live in recovery. I went there because, one, it was a safe place, and two, I wanted a piece of paper that I could stand in front of that judge and plead for mercy to avoid going back to the penitentiary. That was truly just honest while I was there. And that was my motivation for going to treatment. While I was there, we have the story of Ebby and Bill, and that's kind of a transaction of sponsorship in many ways. And the Ebby in my life at that time was a guy named Gary. Now, Gary only had 2.5 months of sobriety. He was probably a little bit younger than I was now when he came into that treatment center. But he came out of it. He was only 2.5 months sober, but he came out of that context. And he wasn't there to be my sponsor. He wasn't there to take me through steps. He was there simply to pour whatever I can give you, laughter, a ride, some coffee, a conversation. That's what he was there to give me. And it saved my life, ultimately. He came into my room. I'll never forget. He came into my room. I never seen a guy in my life. He walked in, and he said, he's got a clipboard, and he's tapping on it. He says, "Hey." And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "You're on the list." And I said, "The list for what?" And he says, "The list to go to a meeting tonight." I said, "Well, what kind of meeting?" He said, "An Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." I said, "What, here in a facility?" He goes, "No, it's out. We're going to go out to it." I said, "I'm not going to that." He goes, "You don't want to go?" I said, "Nah, I'm not interested." And he goes, "All right." And he leaves. And then a few minutes later, I'll never forget, he comes back and he opens the door. And he did nothing but stuck his head in. That's all he stuck in. He goes, "Well, do me a favor." And I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Why don't you try really hard to smile and get it over with?" And then he left. And I'm sitting there with that information. I never heard anybody ever say that before, smile and get it over with. But it, whatever it was, it worked. It was the juice. The juice got me to laugh. Then the next thing I know, I'm looking for the guy. I start scouring the halls, and I finally find him. And I said, "Hey, you still going to that meeting?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Man, that's good." He goes, "Why is that good?" I said, "Because I want to go with you." He goes, "Man, that's great." I said, "Why is that great?" He says, "Because I can't get anybody else to go, right?" Then you knew you swallowed the hook, you know. I said, "All right, let's go." And so we went, and it's just a, you know, this is rural Missouri, up by the Iowa border. We get on, walk down the stairs out to this parking lot, and there's this car. There's no exaggeration to this car. It was a 1970 pea green Plymouth Duster that was held together by rust and bumper stickers. Only thing holding this car together. It was a piece of junk. We could have passed it, just a basket right here that paid for that car. But we get out there, and there's no exhaust. There's no exaggeration. This car is trash. There's no exhaust. There's holes in the floorboard where they're rusted out. He's got floor mats. He's got these cheap old box speakers in the back seat, hot-wired radio and stereo. We're in a small rural town. We're going to go down where all the churches are at, because that's where AA was at, where church alley, if you would. And he cranks his car, whoa, whoa, no exhaust. And so we take off, and carbon monoxide just pouring through the floor. And you're trying not to die from asphyxiation. And he's got a big grin that wraps all the way around his head, because he's taking a new guy to the meeting, you know. And he's got he's experiencing the magic of AA. And he starts giving me the AA pitch, trying to tell me how great his life is now that he quit drinking. And I'm looking at him. He's got prison-issue glasses on. I'm looking at his car. And I think I invented a word right there. I'm like, "Dude, it pretty much looks like your life sucks to me." And he's quick. Alcoholics are quick. He goes, "Yeah, well, tell me about your car." I don't even have a car. And he goes, "And rumor has it up on the ward, you got a pretty big trial coming up. How's that working for you?" So he just stuck a knife in there real quick. Put me back in my place. But we got to the meeting, and this is just, you know, he's not my sponsor, but he's doing what I think we're called to do, even in sponsorship. He's giving me wisdom. He's giving me what he's got. And we get there, and he says, "Hey, man, we're going to go in this meeting tonight. And if they would call on you, let's hope they don't call on you. But if they would call on you, all I want you to do is say your name is Harold and you're an alcoholic. Don't add anything to it." And I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, don't say you're like heralded a junkie or Harold or this. Just say you're an alcoholic, because when you say alcoholic, it's got a very broad definition. We know what that means. You probably smoke some of this. You probably huff some of that. And you're an Ozark Mountain hillbilly. You probably slept with a few farm animals too. We already know that. So just be Harold the alcoholic." So I've been Harold the alcoholic ever since. Some of the greatest, best wisdom I ever given in my life was within seconds. And I went and I sat in the meeting. I sat down next to a guy. I have no idea who it is. And I asked him an important question. It's a question that we all have, whether we know we have it or not. And I had it. And it was a serious question. And the question was simply this: how long do I got to come here? Everything in my life up to that time was time. I knew how to do time. 30 days, 6 months. How long do I have to come here and do this? And it kind of took him off guard a little bit, but his answer was beautiful. He looked at me, he says, "Until you want to." And I thought, man, I don't even want to be here tonight. Much less tomorrow night. I damn sure don't want to be here when I look like you. You know, that's so that wasn't good news for me. was very punitive. Recovery sounded very punitive. There was nothing about it that got me excited. I didn't understand it. It just seemed like we're going to abstain from alcohol for the rest of your life. Fun has packed its bags. It's gone. And you're going to grind it out for the rest of your life. And there was nothing. I wasn't excited about any of that. And I got discharged and I came back to St. Louis and I didn't go to AA. But thank God for that guy, Gary. Long before cell phones, he kept calling me. Did you go to AA? No. Why? I don't know why, Gary. I had a strong desire not to drink, but I didn't have a strong desire to do this. I just didn't. I couldn't have told you why at the time, but I just didn't want to do any of this. But he would say things like, Harold, your life depends on it. And as much as I didn't want that to be true, I knew it was true. I knew that was a true statement, that my life was in peril right now. It's hanging on the fringes. I mean, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in a cage, or I'm going to die and maybe take others with me. So what am I going to do? And he goes, you got to go. And I didn't have a license, wasn't going to have a license for many years. So I got on a commercial transportation bus, a bi-state bus, and went to a meeting. And I couldn't go in. I sat on a bench outside. I watched people going in. I knew there was the right space, and I could not go in that meeting. Fear gripped me. Doubt gripped me. And I couldn't go. And I didn't. And I got back on the bus and went home. And he called and he said, did you go? I said, no, I did not go. Why? I don't know why. I tried to go. What do you mean you tried to go? I said, I told him the story. He said, why didn't you just go in? I said, I don't know why. I don't know why. But I couldn't go do it. But finally I got the courage to walk across an AA club that's still there in St. Louis today called Panther Facility and walked across into a meeting at 5:30 on a Wednesday afternoon. One of the biggest steps I think all of us ever make is that first step into the room and to a thing of unknown, really. What is this all about? I came to AA the same way I did everything else in my life up to that point. I came in with the same self-centered chip on my shoulder. I'm going to do what I want, when I want, how I want, the way I want, and if you don't like it, too bad. But that's just how I flow. And so I was offered everything that we'll talk about this weekend in 1979 in that county detention center. I was offered again in 1980 in the treatment center. I was offered again in 1987 in that treatment center. And now I sat in this room, Alcoholics Anonymous, offer me a design for living that would totally transform my life, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want anything to do with that. And why? And it's a fair question. Why? And I think the best answer is I just didn't believe it would change my life at the end of the day. And I think that's why all of us struggle to look at to life. I had so much individualism, consumerism, materialism in my life. Call me crazy, but I think I could be a little bit more spiritual if I had a few hundred dollars in my pocket. Call me nuts. And a better looking girl, and a car, and a legal driver's license, and a job. This is what I needed to be affirmed. This is what I needed to be somebody. I didn't have any of it. And you want me to give myself to some spiritual way of life in hopes maybe something better turns out? I don't think so. And so I didn't want a sponsor. I had a probationer pro officer since I was 11 years old. And I still have one. So the last thing I'm doing is inviting somebody else into my life to have say-so in life. Forget about that. That's not happening. And so I was on, if you were at the last international conference, it was great. Friday night, the speaker came out and said, you know, I did everything right in AA, but 12 things. Yeah, right? And that was my life. I was on step none. You know, I was on step none. And you're not going to go far in a 12-step program if you never get out to go. It's kind of like you join the gym, and you go to the gym every day, and you talk to the guys, and you watch ESPN Sports Center on the screen, but you never get on a treadmill. You never pick up a weight. Maybe you drink a protein shake. Maybe you don't. But you leave because you get burnt out on it after a while, and then you burn your life up, and somebody says, you know, you really should try going to the gym. Hey, I went to the gym. It didn't work for me. And that's kind of how we do Alcoholics Anonymous, unfortunately, you know, and that's how I was doing it. I got involved in everything you can get involved in. I was a sober drummer. I was a drummer my whole life. I was gifted with that. I had a sober band, and it rocked. And we had a lot of fun playing music, played on sober softball teams. Did all this stuff. But I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't working the steps. But fellowship was keeping me alive. It was the life support. I was making friends. I was doing things. Back then, you know, they have big dances, 500 people at the dances. For whatever reason, I stayed away from the girls. They told me not to be involved, and that's nowhere in our book, but that was just the information that was passed around our fellowship. Just stay out of all that stuff for a while, for a year. So day 366, I was all about that, you know, and but what that cost me, and this is what kind of segmented me to finally started getting me towards sponsorship and coming into this deal. I met an AA girl, met a boy on campus. I was not very long sober. She was only 6 months sober. She was beautiful, a beautiful gal. Came in from Al-Anon. Her name was Kathy. And her and I got together really quick, got intimate. She ended up pregnant. And not long after that, she's like, I'm done. I'm out. I don't want anything to do with recovery. These people, you, I'm out of here. And she left. And I was in a very tough situation because I had nothing. I could write a bad check to Peter and to Rob Paul. I mean, I could do something like that, but I didn't have anything to do anything. And so, but I figured out how to file a paternity suit, and I filed a paternity suit against this woman. And then, of course, I believe the guy she was with the whole time, somebody, a coworker of hers, this guy she was with, they got married and filed a countersuit against me to adopt this child. So I dropped the paternity suit, and I was going to go face this. And that took time for it to develop. But as that's going through time, I meet another gal who's in a halfway house for women. You know, this is really good. So see the pattern here? And her and I get together, and she gets pregnant, and we get married. And in the course of all this self-imposed crisis, this putting yourself in a position to be hurt, my life really started to crumble big time. And I finally humbled myself for sponsorship. The very thing that was offered to me, the very first meeting I went to, I finally said yes to it. And I walked down to a street to a guy named Roy who lived by me. And I could walk to his house. That's one of the reasons I asked him, because he was easy to get to. But he knew me the whole time. And he was about 11 years sober at the time, or maybe 13, somewhere in there. He's about 11 years more sober than I am. And he agreed to invite me to his house. And I went to his house, and I sat with Roy. And I said, Roy, would you sponsor me? And he says, yeah, let's talk about it. Now, you've been around for almost 3 years now. Tell me about your life. Where are you at right now? And I said, I'm 25 years old. I live in the basement of a house up the street. I don't have any education. I don't have a GED. I got a criminal record. I don't have a driver's license. I don't know if I'll ever have a driver's license the rest of my life. My life sucks every which way you take it, Roy. Just take the word sucks, capitalize it, highlight it, italicize it, make a neon sign out of it. That's where my life's at. I said, that's where I'm at. And I haven't drank in 3 years. And he listened to it all. And he's got one of those, he's got a reputation for not being so nice sometimes. But some of those guys are here, I'm sure. Some of you have had that experience. But he was very graceful with me that day. And he said, Harold, I hear everything you're saying. And there's no doubt that you've been dealt a very tough hand in your life. But I hope that you're going to hear what I'm going to tell you. And what he told me that day changed my life. And it's as true that day as it is as I sit here right now. And this is what he said to me. Harold, everything you have in your life, sitting right here, right now, at my kitchen table, every single thing you got going on, you've attracted to you by the person you become. And the day you're man enough to own that truth is the day you're on your way to some real change. But until you can own that, this vicious cycle you're on, you're going to eventually drink again because you're not happy about your sobriety. I know you don't think so because you still got the desire, but you're just like a candle blown in the wind. Eventually it's going to go out and you will drink. Or you're going to do what my dad did. My dad was an alcoholic, and at age 54, he took his life. That's how my dad quit drinking. So you're going to do one or two things. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And I didn't want to go. And I knew what he was going to suggest. Let's pour into the steps. Let's really do this thing. And with every inch of my fiber, I still wanted to resist it because I didn't believe it would change my life. You know, I just didn't believe it would change my life. But I was so broken and beat that we started this journey. And I just tasted so good, I never stopped from that day till now. And my life has just taken off. And it isn't like it's just one straight rocket, but if you were going to look at a stock index like the S&P 500 from 1925 until now, it's up. There's been some big recessions in my life. you know, and I'll talk about a few of those. One of them's coming up right here. But for the most part, it's been an upward trend that I wouldn't trade for anything. It's changed my entire life. And it didn't happen in one big cataclysmic explosion. But little by little, one day at a time, engaging this, embracing this way of life that we talk about all this weekend, it changed my life forever. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I had to go to court. It was that daughter, her name was Megan, was born June the 6th, 1990. And a day came to go to court. My sponsor went with me. My spouse went with me. My family came with me. My boss came with me. And about 30-something members from Alcoholics Anonymous came with me to court that day. I ain't never felt so confident in a court trial in my life until I got up on the defense stand, until the prosecutor got up there and filleted me like a fish. Because even though I had 3 years of sobriety, there hadn't been a whole lot of transformation in my life. And he was able to expose that and use my past against me. And by the time it was all done, that judge hit the thing and said, you know, based on all the evidence presented here today, we just feel it's in the best interest of this child to grant the adoption, remove Mr. Long's rights, case dismissed. And absolutely crushed my life. And all that happened with no alcohol. This is pure self-will run riot. And I went home that day and I crawled up on the couch like a little fetus and I cried as hard as I've ever cried. And I'd love to give you some big, fancy, warm, fuzzy story how that all ends. I'll share more. That sponsorship played a big role in where that's at today. But that's self, which is the root of our problem, is self. Capital S-E-L-F, self, self, self. And I didn't know that truth at the moment. I didn't know that at the time. I'm just starting to learn that truth about my life that would set me free, ultimately. Our good friend Charlie Peace from Texas, some of you knew well. He's a brother to many of you, good friend of mine. I went and spent a couple days with him right the week before he died, when he was still cognitive. We could have a conversation. And I asked Charlie, I said, you know, what's one thing, Charlie, that you wish you would have done different or had a different experience with? He goes, it's easy for me. He goes, I wish it wouldn't have took me 17 years in this program to get the self piece. And I thought, yeah, amen to that. I know exactly what you're talking about. That piece, which is the root of all my problems. But anyway, that's how my journey in sponsorship took off. I didn't understand sponsorship. I didn't really respect sponsorship. I would go to Roy's house in the beginning, and he would give me a lot of good direction, and I wouldn't do most of it. And then one day, I went to his house, same old thing, sat down with my cup of coffee, his coffee. I got my cup, sat down, started vomiting all my woes on his life. He says, Harold, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what's that? He goes, I want you to take your coffee, I want you to dump it out, and I want you to leave. And I said, are you messing with me, man? And he goes, no, I'm not messing with you. I want you to dump your coffee out, and I want you to leave. And I said, why, what's up? He goes, I'll tell you what's up. He goes, apparently your time isn't valuable. My time's valuable. You come here almost every day, drink my coffee, whine, complain, vomit your stuff on me. I give you some wise direction. You don't take most of it. You come back and want to do the same thing over again the next day, the next day, the next day. I'm done. So take your stuff and leave. And I left. And I was split in half. Half of me wanted to cry with my lip hanging out, like a little 5-year-old kicking a can down the alley. And the other half wanted to go back and fight. But it taught me a valuable lesson. It took me about 2 weeks to humble myself to go back and knock on his door. And, can we try again? Yeah. But that changed my life. And that experience. In our circles, we call that 96 in them. You know, the first paragraph on page 96. We'll talk more about that. But it's kind of the language in our circles. It's like, do you think it's time to 96 them? Sometimes that's what it comes down to. And that's what happened to me. I got 96th, and it didn't feel very good at that point in time. But that was my journey with Roy. And so we started this journey in the steps. And so it was just a quest. It was a journey to discover the truth. The truth that would set us free, right? I had no inclination of what that meant, what that looked like. And so when we're doing inventory for the first time and we're doing those things, and we come to my... you know, discovery of what was really going on, the question was, well, what part do you think you play in that? And my pack answer to everything was, I don't know, you know. And so that got to be so humorous that he had a wooden plaque made that said, I don't know, and he hung it on the wall in his kitchen. And so when I would come, and that would be my default answer, he'd smile and point at the sign. And his wife was so tickled by it all that she had the tenacity to go out and get another sign made, a little wooden sign that said, do you want to try the truth? And that hung on the other side of the wall. So this was the sponsorship interrogation I went through. What's your part, Harold? You know, that kind of thing, pointed votes of signs. So this whole process of uncovering, using Chuck C. language, but this uncovering, discovering, discarding what was really the foundation of my life was a revelation for me. It would have never happened without a sponsor in my life. Somebody had been down that road and experienced it. It was interesting when I did my first inventory, and I handed it back to my sponsor. And I said, here's what I've got. And he's looking at it, and he goes, where's your dad on this? I said, Dad? I said, Dad was never in my life. I only saw my dad a couple times my whole life. And I said, the last time I saw him was the first time I was sentenced when I was 14 years old. He came from Oklahoma to the courts in Hillsboro, Missouri, and came to the trial that day. That's the last time I ever saw my dad. I never had anything to do with it. We never were together. So why does he need to be on my list? Well, that's how much delusional I was about my life. That's how, at a subconscious level, buried on a whole bunch of layers of self was the root of this problem. And I couldn't even see it. I couldn't even begin to see it in my life. And so he started drilling me on things. Well, tell me about your dad. I tell him a little what I knew about him. He says, let me ask you a question. Did you ever make up stories about your dad when you were a kid? And I said, what do you mean? I mean, it's like when people had dads, or you're around their dads, they had cool dads, whatever, and somebody would say, what about your dad? And you just make up some lie about it. Man, he had me right there. I said, man, I did that all the time. I made up all kinds of stories about my dad. And he goes, "And you don't think any of that needs to go on the cemetery?" But I started with nothing, and when I finished, I had a great big hole in my soul in the shape of a dad. And I started to uncover and discover, you know, what was really what my life was about with the help of sponsorship. And what a beautiful, beautiful experience that was to have that with Roy. Roy was my sponsor for quite a while. He had his own shortcomings, his own problems, and that caused him to do some things that, you know, weren't really very cool. It's his story, not mine. But it was trying to transition and get somebody different to sponsor me. So I hooked up with a guy named Billy P, who was a member of my home group, and, you know, just to love the guy. And he became my sponsor at that time. And Billy was also, not shortly after that, had a major lung disease where he lost the ability to breathe. And long story short, he ended up with a double lung transplant that lasted for a few years before he finally lost his life. But Billy was huge in my life. He was a single dad who raised six kids. His wife was alcoholic. He was alcoholic. He came into AA. They got divorced. He had the kids. She left, drank herself to death, and he raised these six kids on his own. But he was an amazing man. And so he taught me a lot about a lot of things. But he was there for me. One of the big things he helped me is I got a lot of breaks. You know, my sponsor, Tom I, was my sponsor most of my sobriety. Tom had a quote, and this quote went like this. When preparation meets opportunity and God does introduction, great things can happen in your life. But if you're not prepared for the opportunities, they will pass you by. And so everything that came my way prior to this sponsorship relationship and really engaged in this design for living really did just pass me by for a lot of reasons. But he invited me, I got invited to go into spaces. I made amends to my mom after 3 years and when I started working the steps. And her and I had been just torn apart for a long time because of alcoholism, but I made amends, and she didn't have much of a career, and I'll maybe talk more about her later this afternoon, but she at this point in time had advanced and got into the insurance industry with a major corporation, was one of the first females to ever work in it. And so after I made amends and I showed that I was sober and real about living a different life, she says, I want you to consider coming working for me. And I started laughing. I said, Mom, I appreciate your generosity and your sweetness, but they're never going to let me work for you. I don't even qualify to take out the trash. She goes, well, why don't you let me worry about that? And I said, well, you can worry about it. You knock yourself out. You know, I'm in the trades working construction at the time. She says, I got you an interview. And I went to the interview, and I got past it. Don't even know how I got past it. I finally got to the last guy who was the vice president of the company. They eventually become the president of a major corporation. And I had to borrow a tie from my neighbor to go because I didn't have a tie. But her neighbor, I said, go see Tony next door and get a tie. Well, he worked at Budweiser. He wasn't an executive. He worked on the line. He goes, Harold, I don't got much of ties. Use this one. He gave me a clip-on tie that came down about right here. A brown one, a brown clip-on tie. And I look pathetic, absolutely pathetic. But I go to this interview. I go to this interview. I have to encourage my sponsor. You got to go do this. And I go to this interview. And I sit down, and this guy walks in. His name is Art Johnson. And he looks at me. I had to look really pathetic. And he looks at me. He says, you know, the only reason you're here is because of your mom. I said, yes, sir, I absolutely know that. He goes, no, I want you to know it. The only reason you are here is because of your mom. I have the utmost respect for your mom. So if you work here, and I'm not saying you are, because everything about me says run to the hills, but if I was to hire you, you're going to do three things well. You're going to work smart, you're going to work hard, and you're going to work honest. If you can't do one of those three things, you will not work here. Tell me you understand that. Repeat that to me. And he gave me the opportunity to step into something I had absolutely no business doing, and I had a lot of success with it. And I got a lot of initials behind my name and did a lot of things, but I eventually hit a plateau where I couldn't go any further. And I didn't have any education. And so it's like, well, you can't go any further. I mean, you don't even have a GED. How'd you even get a job here? You don't even have a GED, because they're wondering how I even got that far. And my sponsor, Bill, was like, you need to go get a GED. And I said, Bill, come on. I said, I tried to get a GED twice when I was incarcerated, and both times I quit school when I was 13. I can't pass the GED. As much as I'd like to tell you I can sit down and do it, I cannot do it. He says, then why don't you go sign up for classes? I said, what do you want to mean classes? He goes, why don't you go to the community college, see if they do GED class, and go to the GED. I said, you know, this is really hammering my pride. I said, you want me to go take, yes, go take GED, just go do it, you know, ultimately. So I sign up for it, and I go to GED class, and I'm coming from work, so I'm in a suit and tie, and I walk into this little classroom, probably 10 kids, and they think I'm the instructor. True story. I said, I'm not the instructor. I sat down in the front where I didn't have to look at any of them, right? Because, you know, when I was in the 70s, the early 70s, you know, I took a thumbtack out of my KISS poster and pierced my ear. That might seem to some of you like that's not that big a deal. It was a big deal. But this time, all these years later, they were tatted out and they had piercings everywhere. Some of them looked like they fell down in the nut and bolt section at Lowe's. They had so many piercings going on. They looked a whole lot different than I did back in the 70s. And then one kid next to me, his name was Robbie, had on a black leather jacket, spike wristbands, piercings everywhere, tattoos everywhere, head was shaved with a big giant mohawk about 10 different colors. This is the guy sitting next to me. Teacher's not even there yet. And I can't help but look. He looks like he belongs in a museum. I mean, he looks like a piece of art. You can't help but look at him. And he's looking around, and he jumps bad on me in the middle of GED class. He's like, what are you looking at, old man? That's what he called me. And I said, well, Robbie, because I'm quick on my feet, and I know a lot of humor, too. I said, Robbie, I made sure I said it plenty loud where everybody heard me. I said, you know, I made love to a parrot one time. And I'm just wondering if you might be one of my kids. And so Robbie got a little humor out of that. He kind of laughed about that. But 16 weeks later, because that's what it took, 16 weeks, Robbie was right next to me. He's one of my best guys, and Theon, and we passed our GED. None of that would have happened without sponsorship. If a sponsor would push me that direction to help me take actions I didn't believe in, and this is what the steps in sponsorship did for my life. It made the impossible become possible. All that was there before I ever took a drink. It was just covered in booze and delusion and self. And you can't get to that until you unpack it. I mean, you have, and this is what the steps do. They help us unpack it and remove the blockage that's blocking us off from becoming our best versions of us, which is the sky's the limit. That same sponsor, Roy, I had in the beginning, once he started doing inventory and changing his life, he discovered he could write songs. Never wrote a song in his life. Wrote over 300 since then. He discovered that through the inventory process. So going through those motions was a powerful thing, and my sponsor, Billy, gave me that. By this time, you know, I'm heavily involved in a lot of things. My sponsor told me, and this was Billy, or this is Roy, back to Roy. Roy told me in 1990 when I first asked him to sponsor me, he said, Harold, there's two things I want you to do. And if you do these two things and you do them well for the rest of your life, one day at a time, you will have a storybook life. And those two things were, number one, you always got to have a new guy in your life. If you don't have a new guy you're on this journey with, you stop what you're doing, you get out your rod, you get out your bait, you go fish where there's fish. But you always have a new guy you're walking this journey with. Always have a new guy. Page 100, first full paragraph, one of the greatest promises in the big book. Number two, you need to go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. And you can choose where it's at. I don't care where it's at. It could be treatment center. It could be county jail. It could be the Skid Row Mission. I don't care where it's at. But go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. You do those two things one day at a time, one week at a time, one month at a time, one year at a time, you will have a storybook life. Not a truer statement ever given to me. And through that help, I started that journey through that. And I started in the Skid Row Missions in St. Louis at Harbor Light, Salvation Army Harbor Light, Skid Row Mission and Treatment Center, Low Bottom, Skid Row Treatment Center, plus a homeless shelter attached to one. Really hard place to be. Hardest day I ever did in my life. I went there every Thursday, every Saturday for 3 years. Changed my life. Prepared me for what we're doing today, you know, in that process. But in 1993, I got a phone call, and the guy says, hey, man, I want to know if you'll come out and to this prison and give a talk. And I just busted out laughing. I said, dude, do you know who you're talking to? And he goes, yeah, I know who I'm talking to. I said, man, they're not going to let me come to the prison. And he goes, well, man, I got a lot of clout in that place, and you've been off paper for a while. I'm pretty sure I can get you in. I go, well, let me just say it this way. I made a pact a long time ago. I ain't ever, never, ever going on that side of the fence for you or anybody else. And he kind of chuckled and says, well, why don't you run that by your sponsor? So I did that. I took that advice. And I got with the sponsor. And he said, you got to go. And he went with me, actually. But a few weeks later, or a few months later, really, I get invited to go to the middle of Missouri to a low-level custody penitentiary where the offenders were putting on the program. So they brought like eight of us there. Said, will you come to this program? And I would be honored to come. And we came, and they did this whole workshop for the day, had lunch with them. But at the end, it was kind of like going to a timeshare meeting where, you know, we're going to give you tickets to the movies and all that, but you got to come to this little production. Well, that's what we were in. So at the end, the real reason why you're there is there. And here come the pitch. Well, let me tell us why we really brought you here. We hope you had a good day and enjoyed lunch, but why we brought you here is because we need some people. They've got a max facility outside of St. Louis, and we need a couple guys to take a meeting into that space. Would you be willing to do that? And so that was me and my buddy Henry. And from now, that moment, 1990, till today as I stand here, that's still something I do every single week is going to a maximum security penitentiary. And so through that process of doing that corrections work and going out and talking a lot and doing workshops on corrections, I meet one of my heroes, which is Tom High. And Tom was heavily involved in corrections and really a grandfather of corrections, if you want to call it that, in AA. And so him and I got connected. We were together a lot, and Billy got sick, and Billy eventually passed, and Tom became my sponsor, and was my sponsor for a long time. And in my walk with Tom, every sponsor gave me something. They gave me, I was in a season of my life where I was teachable, and they gave me something that I'll hang on to forever. And Tom was no different. Tom was a three legacy member. And if you don't know what that is, get with your sponsor. Seriously, I mean, it's easy to understand intellectually. Yeah, I get it, but no, you really need to get it. Tom would argue for the last big chunk of his life, the biggest threat to Alcoholics Anonymous is a lack of three legacy groups and a lack of three legacy sponsorship. Couldn't be a more truer statement. I was blessed to be sponsored by a guy who was all about that. And it shaped my life and helped me become the member I am today, and I'm forever grateful for it. But Tom had a, you know, just his persona, how he carried himself. He was so authentic that he didn't come to him repeatedly with a problem. It was pretty much one and done. I'm serious. If you came to him and say, look, I really struggle with the ladies, he would say, if I'm going to work with you, that ends today. So take your choice. Either you go on this journey or it's over with. And it's like, okay, now this is getting serious. It's like, you had a cut and run, or you're going all in. So, I mean, this is how Tom was. And he had such a persona about him that it's like, okay. And you just got in line and you went. And so that really helped shape me. But he walked me through some most difficult times. That gal I told you that I got married to was out of the halfway house, who became the mother to the daughters. After about 5 years, fell into prescription medication addiction and could never get off it. To this day, she's all but dead because of it. She burned her life into the ground. And I was trying to be that, grind through that as the dad for these two girls, and being the guy that never wanted to be divorced, being the guy that wanted to have it all together, because I sponsor guys and I want to hang in there and do all these things until it almost killed me. You know, it almost killed me. But ultimately, I had to make a decision to step away from that. And Tom helped me big time with that. It was not an easy decision for me. It took me 3 years to make that decision. A lot of counseling and going back and forth. Just trying to do everything we could to resolve that. And it just never got resolved. Still not resolved. It's a heartbreaker for her kids to watch her in the state that she's in. But I made a decision. Sponsor walked through with that. That was a huge deal for me to go through that journey. That daughter of mine turned 18 years old, the one that I lost in that court battle. And the other daughters, their half-sisters, that knew about her. They were already in conversation on social media. And I said, Tom, it's time. I think, you know, that I got to address this. He goes, I agree. And so I wrote out a whole letter and sent it back, and we edited it several times until we finally got to the point he goes, send it. You know, and I sent this letter to this girl, and it started a conversation. I'd love to tell you that it just ended well, but it's not. The guy who raised this girl did an incredible job. He's still married to their mother. They had two other daughters. She's had an incredible life. Went to Mizzou, graduated with honors, married to a naval attorney, has two kids of her own, and just has an incredible life. And so, you know, I'm just an acquaintance and a friend of hers that we chat every occasionally online. It's, you know, in the big book it says we look back on our lives, we made decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. That's just one of those examples. You know, but out of it is a beautiful young lady. And Tom helped me walk through that. I tell guys all the time, if I had to sit down and, you know, he said, if you could just sit down for an hour and break open the skull of an alcoholic, what would you, you know, somebody who's really all the way into this thing, what would you pour into them? Well, I could do a whole workshop just on that. But one of those things is I hope you have the experience in recovery that it takes parachute faith to lean into it. I mean, when you say, when you're being guided to go this direction and everybody in your life goes, are you nuts? Are you out of your mind? How do you think that's going to work out? How are you going to do that? And I was, one of those experiences was I had this great career. I ended up going back to school, got that GED, but I eventually went to school and got a bachelor's degree and did what my sponsor told me, because I had all the fear in the world. I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. I could never get through school. He goes, well, let's just do an analysis of your experience in school, Harold. Let me guess that you sat in the back always and that you lusted after every chick in the room just about. You were the class clown, made a lot of buddies, shot pencils in a roof, was a dork, didn't respect a teacher, didn't show up half time. Am I anywhere close? I said, yeah, that's pretty much it. So he goes, so it's not ADHD. It's self-centeredness. Why don't you try sitting in the front of the room, actually pay attention to the teacher, respect the teacher, show up on time, do the work, and see what happens. And I graduated on the dean's list, and I got this degree, And I sent my mom a bumper sticker. I'm 30-something years old, double-digit sobriety. Sent her this bumper sticker that says, "Hey, your kid made the honor roll." It was a great job. But I eventually went across, went on further, and I got a master's degree in business, and I wrote my whole thesis on starting a business from scratch and selling it. And I've not been able to do that not once, not twice, but three times in recovery. And I ultimately went on to get another master's degree. But out of all that, that thesis for that business that I wrote in there, I really had a desire to go do that. But it meant I had to walk away from what I was freely given by the grace of God, no question. A very lucrative situation, just walk away from it all and start with zero. And everybody in your life, for the most part, go, I don't know if I'd do that or not. You got it pretty good. But I really want to go do this. And so I worked through that for 6 months with Tom. And Tom always called it, Tom always had a name for it. He called it a Ben Franklin inventory. That's what he called it. It's really just a pros and cons list. But everything, I don't care if you had, what if you're going to buy a car, whatever, just Ben Franklin it and call me back, you know, or shoot it to me. And so I wrote out a pros and cons list, you know, of doing all this stuff. And it was hard to discern that. But it finally came to time. December 31st, 2009 was the date. And I wrote out this whole resignation letter, and I sent it to Tom, and I said, "What do you think?" He says, "Don't change a thing." He goes, "Let me tell you, I never tell anybody that. We usually got to edit it 5 million times, but don't change nothing. Just send it." And I sent it, and my boss called me immediately and goes, "Are you nuts?" I said, "No, I'm not nuts." I said, this is where I'm being called to. He just couldn't believe it. People were calling me just in total shock that I was walking away from all this. One of the greatest moves I ever made. Took parachute faith to do it. But I can't tell you how that magnified my life. And I hope that you have a chance to have some kind of parachute faith experience in your life. But you definitely want to go through a wise counsel and sponsorship. And Tom went through that with me. About 10 years ago, Tom and I are somewhere doing a Three Legacy workshop, doing a workshop on corrections. I'm sitting out in the audience while he's doing his part. And I've seen him say the same quote 5 or 6 times. And I could see the slippage in his mind. And it broke my heart. It broke my heart. And it wasn't long after that that I got the call from his wife, "Hey, tell people to quit asking him to come because he can't go nowhere no more." You know. And then he called and I talked to him. He always called me Med America or Big Mo. That was always his nicknames for me. And for whatever reason, he remembered me for a long time into his slide. I called him. "Hey, Big Mo," and for just a moment, it would be real and it would be genuine, and then he would say, and "Where are you living at now? And who are you with now?" You know, he just couldn't remember. And then he would ask, "How come nobody's calling anymore? You know, nobody's calling to speak anymore." And it would crush you. And then eventually he died a couple of Septembers ago. On Groundhog Day was his sobriety birthday. If he would have stayed, been alive, he would have celebrated 67 years. So a long time. He's a you know, it's like our Wilbur right here today. He was somebody that was just, we loved, a Willard, you know, we loved dearly in our life. And so he was just that kind of guy for me and countless other people, and a lot of people in the room knew him. He was, you know, he changed my life forever. And that's huge for sponsorship. When he got ill, I asked a man named Steve Lee, I can share it, from Nashville, if he would go on that journey with me. And he was reluctant at first because I'm a couple years more sober than him, but we were just paired so much alike, and he agreed. And so he's been my guy ever since, and I talk to Steve every Friday at 7:30 and fully accountable to him and everything I do. But one thing Tom gave me with that was that we had a weekly check-in time, and it was the same week. I was Tuesdays at 7:30 in the morning. When we celebrated Tom's 50th anniversary in North Carolina, there was about 800 people there that came for his birthday. And they had all of us guys that he sponsored. It was a big group of us in a room. We took a great photo, one of my most cherished moments. But when they had a lot of us get up and roast him, they set us up on the table, and I was the newcomer of all these guys. You got one of them coming here next year is Joe, who's 51 years sober now, or right at there. But they were all on the line. But when they started the roasting of Tom, Larry, Mr. J, good old Texas boy, Mr. J, he starts us off and he says, I'm Larry J, and I'm such and such time. And that's just how it went down. Like, everybody was saying what time they had to check in. It was a big joke. And then everybody, by the time it was over, everybody's dying laughing. But his accountability was tough. When Tom was like, when you asked Tom to sponsor you, it was like, okay, we're going to have this weekly check-in, but you're also giving me consent, permission right now, to go behind you anytime I need to. So if I don't think you're giving me the skinny on your bride, your marriage, you're giving me permission to go talk to your wife. If I don't think you're really what you say you're doing in your recovery circles, you're giving me permission to go to your friends, whatever. You're giving me permission to have any door open that I want to step into. Are we cool? Yeah, cool. I guess, yeah, let's do it. I mean, that kind of accountability was huge for me. And so, you know, I do an 11-step review at night, just, you know, right out of the book and with some other questions I've added over the years. But that's something I send to my sponsor every night. And I send it to all the guys I sponsor, and I send it to a group of guys in my circle. I sent it to a few guys here last night. Just, I'm here. I'm with you guys for a weekend, so just to be accountable to what's going on here. And so that discipline has been huge for me, to stay accountable to my guys and the guys I sponsor, et cetera. So it's made a huge difference in my life. And so I welcome that. In these last few minutes, I just want to share kind of the ugly that I've experienced in sponsorship. And it involves probably every guy here at some level. And I say this, and I say it with love, but I'm saying it because I've just seen it destroy a lot of guys. This is the alcoholics. My sponsor, Roy, God bless him, said this to me when I first got together. And he goes, Harold, there's three things I know about an alcoholic. One, they lie. Two, they lie. And three, they lie about lying. And that's what he told me. It couldn't have been a truer statement, right? But what I learned and what Roy taught me, he goes, Harold, alcoholics have this propensity. It's really their mastery. They're masters at it. To always want to look a little cleaner than they really are. They're masters that they either want to fabricate or they want to elaborate on what's going on in their life. But just to be where they're at is very hard to do. And they're masters at it. I'll give you an example. It's like the old man's down here fishing. We've got this lake behind us. Old man's down there fishing, and a little boy walks up to him and says, hey, mister, have you caught any fish yet? And the old man says, well, if I catch this one and another one, that'll give me two for the day. And the kid goes, wow, that's awesome. Not realize he just told him he hadn't caught anything, right? But he can't just say I haven't caught anything. If you really want to see this play out, play golf. Even with some of your most trusted servants at AA. And you watch them play, and you know dang well that they should have at least a 7, maybe an 8. And you get up there and you're taking scores. It's like, what do you want to put me down? I just put me down for a 5. Like at the end of the round, like a 99 is better than a 94. Who cares anyway? But those 2 or 3 strokes make a difference, right? I mean, that's what I'm talking about, is that. So what I've experienced and what I've seen in myself, but definitely in the brotherhood of recovery, is that we pretty much live by an 80-20 rule. And it's going on here big time, I can promise you. It's that it's kind of an unwritten rule. It's like, Gary, I'm going to tell you about 80% of what's really going on in my life. And the other 20%, not so much. And here's the gentleman's agreement. You can ask me about the 80. I can ask you about the 80. Don't ask me about the 20. And I won't ask you about your 20. And we'll be good. And there's a lot of 80-20, 60-40, 70-30, 90-10 right here, right now. There's guys sitting here, I can promise you, that are this far from blowing their marriages completely up, blowing their lives completely apart because of what's going on. And most of it, it's either secrets that I've never really come clean about in my life, which I had a bunch of those, crimes especially, or it's in your sexual activity 99% of the time. That's where it hides itself. And I've seen it destroy more people than anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. This tendency to want to look a little cleaner, or just don't ask me about the 20. You know, and it's that 20, most of the time it's in that area, and it will kill you. I've watched some of my best friends that I love dearly die, and it wasn't necessarily because of the bottle. One of them hung himself. I watched it too many times. In this room called recovery, because we want to look a little cleaner than we are. And the longer you're sober, the pride and the fear the bogeymen of the day will have a stranglehold in your life. And it's just the truth. So if you're here, yeah, I know, and everybody's here, some of your butt cheeks are really squeezed together hard right now, and you're going, when's this guy going to sit down and shut up? And I hope my sponsor's not listening to anything he says. He's going to ask me about that 20 at break. He's going to ask me about the 20. What's your 20? You know, that's going to bring a whole new thing. What's your 20? But it's the truth, but it will save your life. It will save your life. It truly will. There was an African-American man in St. Louis. He's gone now. He's an old-timer. He's one of my favorite guys on the planet. And his name was Lewis Trotter. Lewis was an uneducated man, very poor health with diabetes, worked as a maintenance guy at the hospital his whole career, never drove, always had a cane, but he had one-liners. He had so much wisdom, but he had one-liners. And I literally got a whole journal called Lewisisms that I could share with you. This is one he gave me when I'm talking about this 80-20 rule. And I'm in a meeting one night vomiting my problems, and he knew right away I wasn't giving full disclosure. And this is what Lewis said in the meeting. I'll never forget it. He sounded like B.B. King when he talked. So when he talked, everybody listened because he just was amazing. But this is Lewis. He'd go, "Well, Harold, sounds like you got a problem with the crap sandwich." And then he just shut up. So everybody's listening. And I took the bait finally. I said, "Okay, Lewis, I'll bite. What's the crap sandwich?" "Well, I'm glad you asked." He said, "The pride's one piece of bread, and the fear's the other. And you know what the problem with the crap sandwich is, Hal?" I said, "What's that, Lewis?" "You're the one eating it." And I probably got some brown stuff on my face right now. I mean, I've eaten a lot of those sandwiches. But there's somebody that got a whole bag full of them in their pocket right here. And that transparency is what, that rigorous honesty, as we would say, that bring it all the way in and all the way out into the light, becomes harder and harder sometimes as the longer you stay here. Because you're the man. You're the group founder. You're the old timer. You're the speaker. You're the step guy. You're this guy. And you can become a very dangerous place for you. And what happens to all of us at some point is like we got one foot way over here in the light, but we still, because we're fatally flawed people, still want to put one foot in the dark. We just want to tip a dough in it. And the problem is with that is you get too much dark in your life to enjoy the light, but you got too much light in your life to enjoy the dark. And you get caught in the middle. But you just can't say it because of the pride, because of the fear. And it's a deadly game. It's a deadly game. My friend, longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, rock star, AA member if there ever was one, sponsored a zillion guys, beautiful wife, kids grew up with my kids that were at my house all the time, his wife, my wife, best friends, great career, engineer. Job said, "Hey, we want you to go on the road. We need you to start traveling and going to some different spaces. And we're sending another engineer with you." And oh, by the way, she's like super knockout hot. And she's married too. And they end up having a fling after being on the road for weeks. And I get the call. Somebody says, "Hey, did you hear about our friend? He's had an affair." And I said, "Yeah." "Well, he hasn't called me directly, so it's none of my business. If he wants it to be my business, he'll call me." I said, "It's none of my business. So I don't even know why you're calling me with it." And I said, "If you're concerned about him, why don't you go talk to him? Because this is gossip, basically." But it was about a week later, he called me. And in the conversation, he says, "Man, I know you've heard what's going on." I said, yeah, I've heard. He says, "Will you come over and talk to me?" And I went over to his house. And this is somebody I've watched 20-plus years of sobriety, somebody who I loved. I mean, I loved. Was so broken. So broken by this act. He said, "Man, I've screwed up my life beyond repair." I said, "It's not beyond repair. Your wife's already said she's willing to work through this with you. You got three beautiful kids," and just so on and on and on. And I tried to get him to do some things. I wanted him to go to the hospital. This is how broken he was. He rejected it. Said he'd do some inventory stuff. But a week later, we're taking my daughter to our family reunion. I get a caller ID shows up, and that's his wife. And I answered it, and she goes, "Hey, I know I appreciate everything you're doing for my husband." And she goes, "You know, we love you." She goes, "But I'm scared right now because we don't know where he's at." I said, "Well, have you pinged his phone? He said, yeah, it's over in Illinois across the river. I said, well, he's either throwing the phone out the window or he's at that spot. You need to send whatever to there. And I called Tom. And I said, Tom, I know I'm going to get a phone call I don't want to get. And he goes, well, you can't be 100% sure. I said, no, I'm going to push back, Spence. I'm pretty sure I'm going to get the call. And I got the call. And they found him, and he hung himself. One of the most painful, grotesque ways you could ever kill yourself. And this guy was as top of the heap in recovery as you can be. Well, what happened? What happened was when that lust for that girl started and the time with this sponsor on the phone, that never came out. And the pride says, I'll deal with it. Pride says, I'll deal with it. Pride says, I'll figure it out. Pride, then I do. And that shame and that turmoil, it was so bruised him. That was the only way he thought he could get out. And they asked me if I would do the eulogy. And the way more people than are here today, just in recovery alone, plus this Rostin Perrine and all the other people that showed up. His kids in the front row who grew up with me. And it was the hardest, hardest thing I've ever done in my life. To sit there and try to celebrate this guy's life after the way it ended. Why did it end? It ended because of what I would call AA's dirty little secret. The secret that I've watched destroy more people than ever. The guy who saved my life, the Ebby in my life, got a call. He's 26 and a half years sober. Hey, man, did you hear what happened to our guy? No, I haven't. You know, he lived in a different town. I said, what, did he die? Because he smoked cigarettes since he was kindergarten. He's 80 years old. I said, did he die of cancer? No, he didn't die. I said, well, then did he drink again? Did he get in trouble? And he goes, oh, he's in trouble, but he didn't drink. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, and he's just putting it on. I said, just tell me, what is it? He goes, he was busted in a child porn ring with 10 other people. And the very guy who saved my life, I went to his trial in St. Louis, federal court, with this kid, the six kids that were all my age or older, and we watched the guy who saved my life, the guy I loved so much, get sentenced to 28 months in federal penitentiary and hadn't drank in almost 30 years. That's the 20% that I'm talking about. That when the temptation comes or I give in to it a little bit or whatever, that the pride and the fear, but their big book tells the bogeymen are right back in our life and they're pressing us from both sides. Pride says you don't have to. Fear says you dare not. You cross your fingers hoping tomorrow's better than the next day, and then it's not. And so as sponsors, I think we got to know that. And the only way to really bring transparency out of the guys we sponsor is if we're transparent with them about what's going on in our life. And not just, hey, I'm going to all these meetings, working with all these guys, but you know, here's what I'm battling sometimes. Not always, but here's my thoughts, good, bad, or ugly. Here's what I'm up against. You know, and so on that inventory, my nightly review, where it normally would say we continue to look for selfishness, dishonesty, and fear, resentment, I added lust to that. It's one of my biggest weaknesses. I already showed you what it cost me in my life. It cost me the hardest sentence I ever got in my life. But so it's important that I just be transparent about these things in my life as they go along. And if I'm not, it could be a death sentence. And it doesn't mean you'll ever drink again. You know, and that's just the reality. So sponsorship is huge. My life would not be here today if not. I sponsor a lot of guys. Sometimes people ask, how many guys do you sponsor? I don't know. However many call me that day, right? That's how many guys I sponsor. I don't really get caught up in that. I sponsor a lot of guys. But it's different. And I'm going to wind up with this piece. I do a lot of work in the prison. Can't work sponsor guys in the prison. It's a compromise to the volunteer status. But here's how I work it in prison. If I got Gary and I got Willard, we're going to make Willard the inmate, Gary. You're the trusted servant on the outside. Willard's our inmate. But Willard says, hey, man, I want to do this now. I'm in max security, so I'm working with guys, long-time guys. I'm going to say, are you serious about this sponsorship? He's like, yes, sir, I am. I got a guy. I go out, Gary, would you be willing? Yes, I'll work it. So I connect them. It usually starts with penmanship. Today they're using email to do this, internet email. But that starts, and then sometimes then it's a phone call, then it's a visitation list, and then they finally come home. Maybe one day they come home, and when they come home, they're already way ahead of the game. They got a sponsor, they've worked through steps, they got a home group of people waiting for them to get out. It's different a day and night how that turns out. So this is just the group sponsorship piece. I do the same thing on treatment. You can't sponsor everybody. I go to a treatment center every Wednesday and do a group at 2 o'clock, and I go, my home group does a meeting in a treatment center in the same place on Sunday nights. We got tons of guys, newcomers, in our meeting from that place. The DCM from District 1, that was the district next to us at our home group not so long ago, and he came up to me after the meeting. He goes, I got to ask you a question. I said, what's that? He goes, I noticed you got a lot of people from Sauna Lake here. I go, yeah. He goes, how do you do that? And I said, I thought it was a trick question at first. And I said, well, don't take this as being a smart aleck. I said, we go there. You know, we actually show up there and say, hey, why don't you come to our home group? You know, and then we sponsor a bunch of these people. But I do the same thing there. I just try to connect these people. When I'm there in that treatment center meeting, I'm here to deliver an adequate demonstration of AA, but also to help you bridge the gap when you walk out that gate. So if you need help with temporary sponsorship, a home group, we want to actually make that happen to you. If you're going to Texas, let me introduce you to somebody from Texas or whatever, and actually get on the phone and make the connections. This whole transparency of walking shoulder to shoulder and helping people rediscover life, it's the magic of AA. It's what it's all about. It's our primary purpose. And if you're not doing it, you're missing the magic. It's the absolute most beautiful thing on the planet. So I tell people all the time, this is what I'll close with. What does it mean to get an AA sponsor? I get this all the time in a home group. I said, well, look at it like this. There's 50 of you sitting in this treatment center. It's like you walk in with a Ziploc bag with a 1,000-piece puzzle in it, and here's my life, and everybody walks into it. And you're sitting in this room, everybody's holding their bag up. Here's my life, and there's some pieces missing. And it seems like it's impossible that it'll ever amount, ever be put back together. And most of you will reject every opportunity to sit down and dump that puzzle out. You're going to give given to it 100 times, but you will reject the opportunity to dump that puzzle out. You're given the opportunity to sit down and do that. But if you do that, if you say, hey, will you sponsor me? Will you go on this journey? Yes, bring your puzzle over here. Let's set up a table and dump it out. And you dump your life out on that table. With no hope that everything's any going to really manage of it. But it's not just that sponsor. It's the guys he sponsors and the guys they sponsor and your home group members. And next thing you know, you got all these people around the table and everybody's putting their hands in your life and putting your, next thing you know, it's got an outline. And the next thing you know, it's coming together. And next thing you know, there's a few pieces missing and God's sovereign hand somehow, some way fills in those gaps. And the next thing you know, you got this amazing, incredible life that you want to shellac, frame, and hang on your wall. That's what you have here if you'll just say yes. And most of you will say no. The sponsorship is what allowed that to happen in my life. And there's nothing more beautiful than to go on that journey with somebody else and have a front row seat and watch them shellac theirs and hang it on the wall. That's the beauty of sponsorship. So that's all I got. Thank you, guys.